Chapter 10. A Chain of Whispers.
"They are still at the Ivy Mansion in Long Saddle,"
Jarlaxle told Dinala.
"And Drizzt's reaction?"
The mercenary shrugged.
"He will be greatly pleased in time, I would imagine."
Dinala considered that rather ambiguous answer for just a moment before replying,
"It is nice when good people win."
The two went quiet as a trio of halflings rambled past, laughing and conversing. They were on their way to the vineyards, it seemed, for one carried a basket, another a hoe, and the third already had her shoes off for some grape stomping. For though the harvest was months away, Pickle Bouldershoulder had woven some druidic magic to coax samples from many vines.
"What do we know?" Jarlaxle asked, when the trio was safely beyond hearing.
"Not much, but it is a bit of intrigue," said Dinala. "It would seem that Lord Neverember has sold a most significant castle here in the north."
Jarlaxle furrowed his brow.
"In Waterdeep?"
"No, not so far down the coast. A place along the shore called Thornhold, bought from Lord Neverember by a clan of dwarves known as the Stoneshafts."
She looked as if she wanted to continue, but Jarlaxle's doubting expression gave her pause.
"Not so magnificent," he explained. "I know this place. It is a ruin unused for decades. Every wall, particularly that facing the sea, is in dire need of extensive repointing at the very least. And the grounds now are no more than brush and stones, and not cobblestones, for most of those were long ago stolen away, those that were not buried under the lava flow and falling boulders from the volcano's explosion those decades ago. I'm surprised that any would pay us silver, when simply inhabiting the place would likely suffice for claiming ownership."
"Definitely not a silver. A rather handsome price, I would expect, since the wagons were escorted by a small army of Stoneshaft dwarves,"
Dinala said.
"Wagons. So curious. And
Stoneshaft?"
"I know this name as well," Jarlaxle mused, but after a moment he shook his head, unable to recall the exact reference. Finally, though, he whispered,
"Stoneshaft." More to himself than to Dinala.
"The name was associated with this Thornhold, I believe. A clan returning to their ancestral home."
"If it was theirs in the first place, where did Lord Neverember score this deed?"
Dinala asked. "A good point."
"You have spies in Waterdeep?"
Dinala stared at him blankly, not willing to surrender any particulars of her network beyond what Jarlaxle already knew.
"Good lady, this may prove important," the drow said.
"Indeed, and that is why I will take what I know and all else I gather to King Brunner."
"And to me, I pray."
"I am happy to share with you, Jarlaxle, but only if it does not undermine King Brunner."
"Happy?"
"Pleased for the business," she clarified.
"Ah, just business. Then you should come to me first. I pay better."
"No doubt. But my dear Regis is loyal to the dwarf."
"And you?"
"I love Regis."
"And prefer dwarves to drow," Jarlaxle said, and heaved a great sigh as if truly wounded.
"I prefer neither. Or rather, prefer you equally," she grinned. "I prefer your gold and their defenses."
It took Jarlaxle a moment for that to fully register, and that cleverness alone charmed him. For it was rare that one could give Jarlaxle pause, and heightened his returned laughter, for indeed he did love bantering with this most talented halfling.
"How long will you need, do you think?" he asked.
Dinala tapped her chin and looked past him, saying, a few times. And Jarlaxle smiled all the wider, for that, of course, was her way of telling him that speed was expensive.
"If the information is readily available, it could well be on its way to me from Waterdeep as we speak," she admitted. "If not, well, I will let you know and perhaps ask for some assistance."
"My contacts in Waterdeep are thin," he said.
"Artemis and Trary is there, though, and the woman named Dahlia, too."
and you have but one spy placed in the greatest city of the Sword Coast, no doubt, came the mercenary leader's sarcastic reply. Donala Topolino merely shrugged and offered a sheepish grin. I have business with Amber and Athrogate, Jarl Axel said, tipping his cap and starting for the tram that would descend to the gates of Gontalgrim.
I should think your road south.
Still walking away, Jarl Axel looked back at her. Their road will indeed be in that direction. Who better to look in on a dwarven castle? And who better to collect information that King Brunner might well need? Other than Lady Donala Topolino, I mean, of course.
Of course, she whispered.
She looked past the cottages and households of Bleeding Vines to the new road running south from the village. She could see the small market plaza just outside of town where it forked, southwest to Neverwinter, and due south to the Tradeway and Waterdeep, and to this place called Thornhold. Her gaze went first to that more southern road, but was inevitably drawn to the other, searching for Regis, her beloved spider. She trusted him and was glad that he had taken it upon himself to be an active member in the spying network of Bleeding Vines. But still, Regis was getting himself entangled with some very dangerous people here, she feared, and with the Lord Protector himself, a man quick to anger and slow to forgive. And more than that, he was far away, and that was a condition of which she most certainly did not approve. He had properly reported his findings to Aberdell and carefully scouted the section of Lord Neverember's audience hall wherein lay the secret stairway. Getting to that door and through it, however, would prove to be a monumental task, one that might force him to consume the very valuable potion he kept at the ready. And without that potion, could he hope to escape? Regis, the castle servant, made a point to linger near that door this day, dusting and dusting some more, and all the while noting the outlines of the portal and searching for traps that might be set against intruders. It was a cursory inspection, of course, for the room around him was not empty of guards, and even if he had been alone, he couldn't rightly find any way to note traps of the magical type, glyphs and wards and such. But he had enough experience to notice anything obvious. And in the meantime he looked, too, for a place where he might hide within the room, stowing away until Neverember and his host of handlers and guards had retired to other quarters. His hopes diminished with every idea, however, for he could see no way he might easily do so. He would have to leave with the rest of the servants and sneak back in, perhaps, and that seemed a daunting task. Lord Neverember was well aware that he had many enemies, and although he was a proven and formidable warrior, he was not a man to take risks regarding subterfuge. The halfling resigned himself to the idea of making another of his valuable potions, but could he even procure the ingredients out here on the Sword Coast? The ones he had garnered for the first dose had come from Aglarond, after all, and at great cost. "Be done with it, fool!" a gruff voice barked behind him, and he nearly jumped out of his boots, which were still boots, although his magical beret made them look like rags wrapped around his hairy feet. Regis held his breath, half expecting a halberd to poke him in the back. "You'll rub the glass right off that pane, dawdler," the guard grumbled. The complaint made Regis consider the present circumstances and get his mind off any future plans, and in doing so, he saw that he had indeed done a fine job cleaning this particular pane of the 100-paned great window behind the Lord's seat, although the rest of the window remained quite streaked and dirty. He paused for just a moment to glance out at the late afternoon sky, the sun nearly dipping below the cold waters of the sea. His gaze moved down to the coast, then inland across the city to the base of the Lord's castle, and to a canal, mostly frozen but disappearing under the wall right below this window, and very near the stairwell door. Was it possible? A rider did come up that southern road before Donella turned back to her house. Too tall for Regis, and on a horse, not a pony. She thought it curious at first, but then, as she realized the woman's identity, it seemed downright alarming. She stood there in the middle of the road and felt as if the world were bending around her, her fears making all but that one approaching rider indistinct. Iberdella Lali, who should not be here. The elven woman galloped her horse up to Denala, skidding it to a stop, and dismounted before the sweating creature had even fully halted.
"Milady Topolino," she said with a quick curtsy. "We just spoke," Denala said, fumbling for the words. "Just yesterday at sunset."
It was true enough. Denala and her attendants had arrived for their ponies at Iberdell's stable soon after Regis had prepared his potions and departed on his return to Neverwinter.
"Events move quickly," the elf replied. "I thought you should know." "News of Spider?"
Denala asked, hardly able to get the question out, fearing the answer.
"Aye, lady. He returned to me very late last night, long after you had set out for home." "And he is safe?"
"Back in Neverwinter," Iberdell answered, and she sucked in her breath and shrugged.
"He was safe when he left me, to be sure, but he had that look in his eye." "That look?" "Adventure." "He often has that look, and often finds excitement. Why would you—" "I thought the information too important to wait for another of your associates to hire my services."
Denala motioned for her to continue.
"There is something great afoot, lady. Dwarves sailing north and marching south, laden with a dragon's hoard worth of coin. Indeed, I already—" "And Margasters of Waterdeep all about, twined with the dwarves, I would guess." "Margasters?" "House Margaster of Waterdeep. Brevinden Margaster stopped at my stables, then went north, just before the dwarves came south. Lady Incarry Margaster stood with Lord Neverember when the dwarves purchased Thornhold, and the Driftwood Tavern is thick with Margasters."
"Is this unusual?"
"There's more,"
Iberdell promised, lowering her voice. Regis crept around the back of the castle, sliding from shadow to shadow. He came up on the levee of the canal, which directed it under the structure. The current was not strong, and small patches of ice were scattered here and there, with the occasional flow moving past. This was the sewer serving Lord Neverember's castle, and only this castle, at least upstream. Regis could only hope he'd find a way out of the flow before the waste channels found their way in. He glanced around, pulled off his heavy cloak, and tossed it behind a bush near the castle wall. He had already stripped off his vest, shirt, socks, and boots, wearing only breeches, his sword and dagger belt, his beret, and the hand crossbow hanging around his neck. He closed his eyes and tried to summon his courage, reminding himself that he had gone to the cold depths of the Sea of Fallen Stars in search of oysters and their valuable pink pearls. This water before him was colder than that, surely, but it was not deep, and he would not be in it for long.
"The Ganassi protect me," he whispered,
and he slipped down the side of the levee, disappearing under the dark water without a sound, even as his mind screamed in protest at the frigid cold. Under the castle wall he went, swimming with the current right up to a closed grate. Regis stayed under the water, the Ganassi heritage granting him the ability to hold his breath for a long, long time. He could see nothing, but his nimble fingers walked all about the grate, finally coming to the lock, and he was relieved to discern that this was not a portcullis, but a simple swinging gate. He brought his hand to his lips and spat forth a pair of lockpicks, then went to work trying to put aside the possibility that the thing could be devilishly trapped. He simply hadn't the time for that. In short order, though it seemed an eternity to poor cold Regis, the gate popped open, and he wasted no time in pushing through, then gliding effortlessly along the canal. When he rounded a bend, he noted a light above, shining through the pattern of small floes drifting about. Slowly, the halfling's head emerged. He was in an underground chamber, a torch burning somewhere beyond his limited vision, for he was facing a ledge of stone. Above and beyond it he heard talking, a human voice, speaking in the common tongue and with the strong accents of peasant folk.
"Bah, but for all their gold, they can't pee me more than a finger of copper," the man grumbled.
Regis heard some scraping, like a metal rake on stone. He sank back under the water, then came out like a sleek fish, contorting his body perfectly to climb free to his waist and beyond, enough for him to grab the lip.
Slowly he pulled himself up until he was peering over the edge. Relief flooded through him as he realized that the peasant was talking to himself. The bent man shambled about the small dock room, raking hay from the stone floor, likely the spillover from some chamber bucket given the smell. Regis slipped back into the water, treading easily. One hand went to the chain around his neck, pulling forth a small bolt, taking extra care when he extracted the dart from the cork. One scrape from the dart could have him floating back along the canal, snorting and gurgling. He set the dart to his hand crossbow and very slowly and quietly drew it and locked the bent bowstring. Down he went under the water, except for one hand holding the weapon. Then out he came again like a fish, springing up and catching the top of the ledge once more with his free hand.
"Hey, who's that splashing then?" he heard the man ask.
Regis quickly tapped his beret, thinking of a frog, of a lizard man, anything that would make him unrecognizable. Then he came up fast and just in time, for the laborer was right there before him, rake held high and ready to strike. But Regis kept his calm and shot first, nailing the poor fellow in the chest right near his heart. The quarrel barely penetrated, and Regis was glad of that, for a heavier weapon would have killed the man on the spot. He didn't need the dart to do much damage, though. That's what the drow sleeping poison was for. The laborer staggered backward, grabbing at the wound, wailing, "I am killed to death!" Regis almost rolled his eye at the melodramatics.
"You're not dead," he murmured. "Just going to take a little nap."
The larger man tumbled over onto the floor, upsetting several chamber buckets, and was snoring before he hit the stone. It wasn't until he extricated himself from the canal that Regis realized how close to the edge of disaster he had been in the freezing water. He found that he could barely stand on his feet and couldn't feel them at all. He moved to the torch and began rubbing himself briskly with his hands. At one point, he even pulled the torch from its sconce and ran it all about his shivering form, near enough that he occasionally felt the sting of a stray spark. He dropped his weapon belt and stripped out of his breeches, pulling open his magical belt pouch to retrieve another pair and the rest of his clothing. Soon he was the dapper spider paraffin again, and he could even feel his warming toes wiggling in his fabulous black boots. He moved to a door at the back of the chamber, listened carefully, checked it for tripwires or pressure levers, then cracked it open. He knew at once that his guess had been correct, fortunately, and that he was within a larger complex of tunnels. The ones outside the small, hidden canal-side chamber moved directly under the main castle as well. If there was a staircase behind that secret door in Lord Neverember's audience hall, it almost surely would intersect with the tunnels now before the halfling. So he used some of his daylight oil to brighten a small board, and out he went, creeping along. The floors were not smooth here, as within the entry chamber, and the walls not square, and indeed more rounded. These were lava tubes, remnants of the volcano that had buried Neverwinter City a few decades before. The tunnel wound around a bend, then straightened, and Regis sighed, wondering if it would take him beyond the complex altogether, if perhaps this was not the way in after all. Except, he then noted, this long, straight stretch of lava tube had four distinct alcoves cut into it, two on each side with a tight-fitting door set in each. Tight-fitting, heavy, and locked, Regis realized, as he moved quickly from one to the next, listening only briefly. He figured that he wouldn't hear any sounds behind the heavy portals, unless he happened upon a clan of ogres bowling with dwarves or some other such ruckus.
"Inky Stinky, get some gold," he whispered, with every uttered beat pointing emphatically at a different door in line. First to last, then back again, one by one. It seemed as good a way as any to determine which he would first enter. "Never let an orc grow old. Give its scrawny neck a feel. Twist it tight and make it squeal, and put it through this door when cold."
He moved to the second door, the first on the right-hand wall, and again stopped to listen. Nothing. How could there be? With a sigh and a glance around, the halfling put down his glowing board and went to work on the lock. He set the tension bar in firmly, telling himself,
"There is no trap, there is no trap," repeatedly as he tried to build confidence,
for any doubt would slow him, and he didn't want to be in this place any longer than necessary.
The pick went in easily, but didn't move so readily once in the mechanism, which was extraordinarily crowded. Again, Regis swallowed hard and recited his mantra about traps. He worked and quieted his entire body, every sense focusing on the task before him. He had practiced these arts since his birth in this reincarnated existence, determined not just to be good at his craft, but to be the very best. He found a reward for those many years of practice. One pin, two pins, three, four, five. Regis fell back and stared at the lock in surprise. In went the pick once more until three more pins had been thrown, and finally, the extraordinary lock clicked fully open.
Eight pins?
Regis whispered, marveling at the magnificent contraption, and at his own skill, for he suspected that there weren't five burglars on the Sword Coast who could have picked this lock. Well, not counting Kalimpost, of course, where thievery was the city's celebrated pastime.
Don't get sidetracked, he told himself.
He stared at the lock a few moments longer, thinking that if he came up empty in the rest of his searching, maybe he'd just find a way to take that. The door opened into the room or tunnel beyond, so he eased it just a bit, then checked the threshold and jamb for any pressure plates. He eased it a tiny bit more and checked again, and a good thing he did. He pulled his full pack of thieves' tools from his pouch and found a hair-thin strip of metal and a small jar of glue. Treating one side of the metal strip, he slipped it in between the door and the revealed pressure plate, pressing the sticky side as tightly as he could to the jamb. He eased the door a bit more and checked again, and indeed found yet another trap of some sort, similarly designed. Once more he went to his pack and disarmed the mechanism with a second sticky plate. Finally, the edge of the door moved past the jamb altogether. Regis suspected there were more dangers in his path, but any further traps were likely in the room just beyond the portal, and so out of his ability to discern. He stepped back, looked left and right, then kicked the door and leaped back into the side, and just in time, for as the door opened in, right to left, it released a heavy-bladed pendulum, swinging perpendicular to the threshold. It swung right out into the hall with a blade so long that it would have creased Regis from crotch to forehead. Back into the room it went, then back across the threshold, and a third time, showing little indication of slowing. His patience lost, Regis timed the next swing, and as the pendulum went back into the room, so did he, tossing his magical torch ahead, leaping across the threshold, and diving into a roll off to the right side of the doorway. Both of his melee weapons, rapier and three-bladed dirk, were in the halfling's hands when he came up from that roll, to find himself alone in a small square chamber with a raised wooden floor, stacked with barrels and chests. He glanced back toward the hallway and the still-swinging pendulum. He wanted to close the door, of course, but that would not be possible, for there seemed no way to reset the trap and get the pendulum out of the way, although now its swing was lessening noticeably with each reversal. Even when it stopped, though, Regis figured he had little chance of closing the door, for he could tell that the pendulum was simply too heavy for him to push it back enough to get the door shut in front of it. He had to be quick, because his entry would be noticed. Blades away, he went for the stacked barrels and chests, but his smile disappeared when he found them filled with mundane items to run a large household, such as candles, wine and water, and foodstuffs. After perusing only a few, he snorted aloud and shook his head. Why would they go to such trouble to triple trap and hard lock such a door? No, it didn't make sense. So he pressed on, rolling some barrels out of the way and discovering, at last, something curious. A decorated basin of white stone, a singular carving of basin, pedestal, and base that brought its lip as high as Regis's hairline. The halfling tested its weight, then grabbed onto the side and slowly pulled himself up to his tiptoes, trying to get a peek inside the bowl. So heavy and balanced was the basin that it didn't even jiggle as he put more of his weight against it. That gave him the courage to lift a bit higher when he noted that the bowl was full of crystal clear and odorless liquid, like pure water. Holy water, perhaps? Some other ceremonial liquid? A magical potion? He brought his arm to the edge of the bowl for leverage and pulled up higher, trying to see what might be inside at the bottom of the bowl, and he felt himself rewarded when he noted a glitter there, like a diamond. Or a bubbling flow, he thought, when the water extended up into the air above the basin.
an enchanted fountain.
But no, Regis realized almost immediately. The water did not splash apart and fall back in like a fountain, for no, it was not being propelled by any flow. It was lifting itself up, and with definitive form. A living creature. Regis flung himself backward, or tried to, but the water monster proved faster and slapped a wet tendril around his head, catching him and yanking him forward, pulling his head over the side of the bowl and pressing it down into the water that this magical being considered its home. And there it held him, face pressed against the bottom of the bowl. And all Regis could do was take some minor solace in his Ganassi heritage once more.